WFM.
With Green Farm, healthy snacking made easy with Green Farm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Thanks to the amazing Jenny Green. She had us bouncing around the studio with Carnival de Paris from Derry OG. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of December, and this is Game On.
Top class knowledge. Coming up today, we'll have the latest on Irish horses and jockeys restricted from racing in Britain over Christmas. We will hear in just a few moments from Henry de Bromhead as Monalee is set to miss out.
And upwards the finish. It's Monalee all the way in the Red Mills chase and is set to justify his upcoming Cheltenham entries. Wins for Rachel Blackmore and Henry de Bromhead.
In rugby, we've my old boss Dean Ryan joins us to discuss player shortages due to COVID. We've European football with Mark Langdon, plus we've the director of a new film on when the Tour de France came to Ireland.
Game on 2FM.
And you can text us between now and 7 o'clock. Our number is 51552. You can tweet the programme as well. You will get us on @GameOn2FM. Carnival de Paris. We've been chatting amongst ourselves here, Donnick. You know, like a piece of music just brings you back to a moment in life.
Where were you?
The World Cup in 1998 in France. I can't tell you whether or not that World Cup was actually any good, but that song just makes me think it must have been the greatest World Cup ever.
It does, doesn't it? It just brings you back to the summertime and just gives you a massive lift.
Yeah, and you know as well, I am in the hottest studio I've ever sat in, so I feel like I could be in Paris in the height of the summer and not a bother on me.
Oh, well, I'd give for a bit of heat. I'm in the Cork studio here and it's quite cold. John Creedon, I think, is also an Arctic explorer. He likes the place fairly cold, so the windows are wide open and it is fairly Baltic.
Yeah. How are you? Are you you all set for the madness of the next couple of days?
I'm great, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. A bit like yourself, Damien, our kids are at a beautiful age, 10 down to 5, so there's just incredible excitement and the nerves have kicked in. Plus, there's only a few days left of that elf on the shelf.
I have, oh yeah, thank God for that. I have, I think most kids finished school today, certainly mine did, and I have that feeling that I think is unique to the Irish man, where I think everything is done, I think everything is ready, but then at the back in my mind, you know that scene in Home Alone where Catherine O'Hara is on the plane and she's like, did you turn off this, did you do that? And I just know there's something at about 6 o'clock tomorrow evening that I'm going to go, oh no.
Do you not pack away the just in case present?
Oh, I have loads of them.
Oh, do you?
Oh, I have a mountain of them.
Well, there's people listening now, Damien, and I know they haven't got a just in case present and we could help them out.
Oh, yes.
Yes, here we go. Watch this unbelievable segue into our brilliant competition. To celebrate 30 years in Ireland, Tahalgo have given us 3 luxurious men's skincare hampers worth over a whopping €100. Each one includes their amazing products, which are sure to keep your skin looking renewed and youthful after Christmas. You can check out their full range of products and they do brilliant gift sets on tahalgo.ie.
Now, I'm not allowed to give away clues, right?
Right.
But I'll just point out that Laura Lee, who works on the programme, is the glue that holds this and other programmes together.
Very true.
Did tell me that as a Bohemians fan, she has intentionally made me read out the question. So to be given a chance to win one of these hampers, just answer the following question. Which team are the current SSE Electricity League champions? I'll give you a clue. It's not Bohemians, but it could be one of their rivals. Text the word hamper followed by your answer and name to 51552 and we'll pick 3 winners before the end of the show. And as always, RTE competitions terms and conditions apply, and you can see 2fm.ie for more details.
Very good. Yeah, a brilliant competition, brilliant Irish ranges there. So get involved and, a good way to get you out of a hole in case you're stuck.
It is. It's a strange day. I think there's a lot of people. There's a bit of a mood hanging over the country, really, I think, isn't there?
And yeah, there is. The announcements today. And I think that just the numbers, Damien, I'm not too sure, but I've seen over 900.
970. So.
Yeah, it is a fright.
So hopefully, I think the most important thing over the next couple of days is let's just all look after each other. Let's try and get through it as best as we can. Let's try and have a bit of a laugh, do things with a smile on our face. And it's really tough, but hopefully things will come back to some semblance of normality sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and look, maybe it's something that just happens in sport, but when things kind of get a little bit tough and out of order, you just make sure of your own area, you know, and it's mad if you look after your own kind of role and make sure you're doing everything you can, keeping your distance, you know, just keeping it to smaller circles, washing your hands. Look, I don't want to be preaching, but I think no one wants to put anyone in any jeopardy or any, harm's way. So if we, like you say, if we can look out for each other, a little bit more. There was news of sports, though, and we did hear that tennis and golf will play on as normal, Damien. That is quite exciting to hear, because I think they're both sports that allow for social distancing and are quite important for people getting out and socialising.
Yeah, I thought for a second you were going to tell me to trust the process. I thought you were heading process. In that direction of look after your own area.
We start at zero, we are where we are.
Win the next half.
We review the process on Monday and get back to it.
Right, we start doing that at 7 o'clock. We should have a phone call and, you know, review the process. You mentioned sport that is ongoing. We're going to mention tomorrow night, we're going to look ahead to what is a really busy festive period for rugby and soccer. And I know plenty of other sports kind of fill an awful lot of hours for a lot of people over Christmas and the new year. And amongst those sports is racing. And it has been announced today that it has become very clear today that no Irish trainer horses or jockeys will be allowed to compete in Britain until the 31st of December. That due to the Irish government ban on UK travel. There was a statement earlier on from Horse Racing Ireland, which effectively, to quote Brian Kavanagh, has pointed out that it's exceptional times. A travel ban with the UK, as we all know, is a once in a generation occurrence. And Horse Racing Ireland advising that no Irish trained horses or jockeys should travel to the UK for competition between now and the 31st of December. We'll chat to Henry de Bromhead in just a moment, who obviously is affected by this. But Don McLean joins us first. Don, how are you?
Good, thanks, Damien. Yeah, all good.
Can I ask you a potentially stupid question, but it wouldn't be the first time. So Horse Racing Ireland are describing this as an advisory. We know that there is a travel ban in place, but would horses be allowed to travel to the UK if people wanted to as freight? Like, is there actually a ban on people competing, or is it effectively an appeal on people not to compete?
No, I think the HRI have instructed, Damien, that horses can't go and people can't go. So yeah, I think it's more strict than that. And also they've instructed the reverse as well, that British horses aren't allowed to come over here and compete over the course of the Christmas period. And there were a couple of horses that were coming over. Ollie Murphy, I think he was intending bringing Thomas Darby over for the Christmas hurdle. But as you say, Henry de Bromhead, he's probably the most high-profile trainer, and he's got probably the most high-profile horses affected. Manna Lee, he'd been on track for the King George on St. Stephen's Day for quite a while, put the kettle on. She was going over for the Desert Orchid Chase at Kempton as well, but they can't go now. And look, as yourself and Dunnock were discussing there are wider issues in the world, and it's just a blip, I think, that the two horses can't go over.
Well, let's hear from the man himself. He joins us on the line. Henry, good evening to you.
Hi there, how are you?
Not too bad, thanks for being with us. I know there's very little you can do about this, but horse racing has played such a key role in showing people how sport can operate in a safe environment that I presume you and a lot of people, while disappointed, you bow to the inevitable and you get on with maybe setting the example that needs to be set.
Yeah, that's it, absolutely. It's obviously disappointing for everyone involved. We were looking forward to going over with them. But unfortunately, there's bigger things going on in the world. We just have to accept it. And look for opportunities here. You know, thankfully, we can continue racing here. That's a positive anyhow, which is great.
Henry, of course, we're looking after safety and we want everyone to be safe and well. Logistically for you, what does this mean now? Do you have to evaluate the whole yard and even decide on, you know, different races that you maybe had thought you wouldn't put certain horses into?
It's not too bad. There was Mona Lee, obviously, was going for the King George, and then Put the Kettle On was going to go for the Desert Orchid Chase the following day. So she'll just switch to the 2-mile-1 chase at Leopardstown on the 27th. Unfortunately, she'll be running as Notebook and another horse of ours, Notebook, and Chacon Poursois, who's the hot favourite. But look, she's a really good mare, and she would have been taking on Altior in the Desert Orchid. So wherever you go, you know, they're all pretty competitive races. So she'll just automatically switch to that. And then Mona Lee is in the Savills Chase on the 28th at Leopardstown. He'll also be entered for the Savills Chase in Tremor on the 1st of January. So they're two good options. We have a couple in the chase at Leopardstown already, and Barry Maloney, who owns Monoli, also owns Manal Indo, who's in that. So whether he'll want to have them taking each other on, I'm not so sure. But there is the option of the Alpine Photo race, the Savills Chase and Tremor taking him on. Or we might look further afield at maybe the Irish Gold Cup or something like that and skip Christmas altogether. So I haven't really finalised with him, but plenty of options. And yeah, so it's not too bad.
Just on that, Henry, doing bulletins yesterday on Radio 1 and, you know, a clip lands true of Nicky Henderson talking about Santini and how he's looked so impressive in the yards that why wait 5 weeks for the Cotswold Chase at Cheltenham when you can get him a run over Christmas and pay the supplementary fee. But from your perspective, and I realise this is very fresh in your mind, there's an awful lot of considerations in terms of do you now go and seek competitive runs, or, you know, do certain horses need a competitive run compared to working away in the yard and looking at what would have been your next option down the road? That it's not just as simple, I would imagine, as looking at the diary and seeing what can slot in place of whatever else.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, and that's something I'd say we may have to consider with Monoli. You know, he's in mighty form. He's not getting any younger either. You know, he's 9 rising 10 now. So we'll see. We'll discuss it. We'll look at our options. And as you say, we might be tempted to get him out over Christmas, you know, if there looked to be one of the options suited. We're dealing with horses, anything, touch wood, anything can happen. So we'll just have to see how it all unfolds in the next few days.
Don, just looking to how this could impact the card, from a selfish point of view, it could lead to great racing in Ireland over the Christmas.
Yeah, look, as Henry says there, Donica, if Monoli were to line up in the Savills Chase, that would be, it would enhance that race for sure. Or if he were to now skip the Savills Chase at Leopardstown over Christmas and go and take on Alpine Photo at Tremor on New Year's Day in the other Savills Chase, that would be real competition for Alpine Photo, the dual Gold Cup winner. And to have put the kettle on as well, racing in Ireland, like, she's a top-class mare, she'd enhance any race. She goes for the 2-mile chase. Then taking on Shackle Persuad and Henry's other horse, Notebook, that would make that a hell of a race. So, yeah, I suppose, that, you know, they're top-class horses, so wherever they go, Donica, they're going to enhance races. So, yeah, just looking forward to seeing them out again.
Henry, just before we let you go, obviously horse racing was the first sport to really get up and running again after the initial lockdowns that we've had. Has there been a pressure, or have you felt an extra burden of responsibility amongst, you know, trainers and jockeys to set the example and show that certain sports can be run safely and you know, certain sports can survive this pandemic that we're going through?
I think, in fairness, HRI and the IHRB did Brian Kavanagh, well, everyone at HRI, everyone at the IHRB, especially Jennifer Pugh, our doctor, have done an amazing job to set the protocols that we have, you know, very strict protocols. And in fairness to them, I think they've done a really good job and probably set a precedent for other sports. So it was quite a lot of hard work at the start, but we've all got used to it now, and touch wood, it seems to be working well. So it's just great when you hear of other industries that are having to to stop. It's fantastic for our industry that we can keep going.
Yeah, it has been incredible. Don, it's a bit far out yet, but is there something you're looking forward to over the Christmas, the racing-wise, that already is jumping out? I know we're a bit out just yet, but something that's caught your eye?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it all, Donica, really. Like the King George in Kempton, that's going to be a hell of a race. Flanders Ovo going for his third King George. And then over here, we've got 4 days at Leopardstown, 4 days at Limerick, which is brilliant. Like, that Savills Chase at Leopardstown, I suppose that's the highlight for me, Donica, you know, to have Manella Indo, he's last year's leading novice, one of last season's leading staying novice chasers, to be taking on the big boys now, presenting Percy and Del to work horses like that against Manella Indo, that's going to be great. The Christmas herd, it looks like Sir de Burley and Fury Road and Ronald Pump are going to run in that. That should be a hell of a race as well. I suppose the Christmas herd, like Kempton as well, see Epitant again. So it's just top class racing all over the place, Tonica.
Yeah, Don, as always, thanks so much. Henry, best of luck. I know it's disappointing to have to move the goalposts, but everyone's doing their best, and we've no doubt you'll bring your best when you get out there. Thanks as always for joining us on Game On. We're going to take a quick break and we're back chanting rugby. Oh no, we're not.
Game On on 2FM with Green Fern. Green Fern's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour.
Game On Rugby.
Okay, we mentioned yesterday that a quarter of the Champions Cup games were cancelled last weekend due to COVID-related issues. One team that fronted up missing 17 players was the Dragons, and we're delighted to be joined by their director of rugby, Dean Ryan. Dean, how are you?
Evening, Donica. How are you?
I'm very good. Dean, it must be incredibly difficult. I think, you know, just managing squads at the best of times is hard. I know it as a player myself. Everyone wants to play. You've got a blood young players. But, you know, it's been really, really difficult. And just looking at your team at the weekend, having to put young players in there, especially a young fly half, giving them their debut in a place like Bordeaux must be so tough.
Yeah, it's been tough for about a month, but obviously having the Champions Cup on the horizon was such a big focus point for us. It's been 10 years since the Dragons ever qualified. We felt we're in good shape. We had wins away in Benetton, wins away in Glasgow, and with international guys returning, we saw it as just a great experience. I don't think we ever saw ourselves as sort of making a stamp in this tournament, but we saw ourselves as a huge stepping stone to being better in the future. And then suddenly, well, it was the morning of the WASC game, we came to learn that we'd had two positives in the camp on the Friday and we lost eight players, and it just changed the focus. It just became about how could we represent the Dragons in the best way? How could we get a team out? How could we keep this experience moving? And, and that culminated, you know, Bordeaux away at any stage for any side is a major challenge. And we ended up having two guys in their first professional games in their careers away in Bordeaux. And as everything, if you put someone on the bench hoping he might get 10 minutes at the end, he's on after 10 minutes. And, you know, it's a pretty full-on debut for a young fella, and a tough day at the office. But you know, it was essential for us that we continued to enjoy the experience because we waited so long for it. And you know, it is difficult circumstances at the minute for everybody. But we didn't want it, although it changed our experience, we didn't want it to be taken away from us.
Does that frustrate you then, Dean, when you see other teams that don't take the experience, that, you know, find other ways? I know they're, you know, we chat about the 28 nils, but, you know, your moral compass in rugby is high and you want to fulfil the fixture, whereas you see other teams that probably get rewarded for not.
I think I certainly would ask some questions of what EPCR do next. I know there's two sides to any COVID situation. There's, you know, if it's hitting you, how do you manage it? How do you contain it? How do you keep people safe? But there's also a concern from another side. And what we saw on the weekend was a different interpretation from whichever countries that you came from. And there is inconsistencies at how COVID criteria is applied. And when you put that into a competitive environment, there's always a risk that gets taken to the nth degree. And you know, it is disappointing. I am interested to see what happens next because, you know, there's some people said to me, wouldn't you take 28 nil? And I'd say, not a chance. I'd never take someone the experience of losing or being involved in a Champions Cup game because some people might go the whole career and never do it. So to take that away from somebody, I think some of the sides that might be looking at it differently are potentially just playing a little bit of disrespect about how difficult it is to get there.
But Dean, the flip side of that then as well is we look at the Pro 14 where there is a window to replay games or reschedule games, but it's so tight from a European perspective, particularly with the new format to allow the increased situations, that in many ways are the EPCR's hands tied with regard to a lack of a space within the window to reschedule games?
I think absolutely. I don't think anybody sees them being rescheduled, but I just don't think anybody really saw this. And we are dealing in, you know, difficult times. We are sort of writing things on the hoof. But we have got to protect our tournament. So we've got to do us. So by no means do I think it's something that's easy. There's no way you can replay. But it'll just be interesting what the next steps are. Is, you know, I think everybody's having to adapt to pretty difficult times, whether it's in domestic leagues or in European leagues. But the last thing we want to lose is the integrity of our competitions. And I think it's really important that that finds its way through, even if there is difficulties, even if there is adaptions on the way. The integrity of competition is key.
And Dean, just on that, a bit like us, we go into our Interpros now. We have a daunting Christmas. Stephen's Day, you play the Cardiff Blues, and then on New Year's Day, you've the Scarlets. You know, down and managing your squad. How are you going to, you know, get that done over this bit of a period? It could be quite difficult with injuries on top of COVID.
It is, and I've never looked so forward to results in the middle of the week, because we're obviously tested every week, and it's become, the last few weeks has become pretty difficult as results come. I think the difficulty we had against Wasps was how late in the week we had two guys symptomatic, which ultimately affected what we'd done on the Thursday and Friday with close contact. So we're hoping, we've changed a little bit about how we train in a week, so when we get our test results, we hopefully can contain that situation to one or two. But at the same time, it's derby time, it's Christmas time, it's pretty difficult for everybody. They're sat at home, and we hope that we can get a full complement of players to those that are available. We hope that the majority of players come through this. We've got those who were isolating over the European period back, and fingers crossed. I sit on Tuesday nights, Wednesday mornings, waiting to see the full list of test results.
Dean, COVID aside, a big issue in our game at the moment has been concussion, and English rugby, there were surveys today saying that it's at an all-time high. I know you would have played a fair bit as well. Just from your own experience, where there was, you know, no HIA testing, and we're hearing an awful lot of players like Steve Thompson, but even in your vintage playing-wise, how far have we come in terms of assessment and what can be, you know, further done to improve player safety?
I think I've been involved for quite a long time now. Some time ago, I was involved in a series of concussion incidents, which involved three in a week, which was my responsibility. Is I hid two of them at a period when we were supposed to sit out for 3 weeks and ended up in a significant period of unconsciousness in a game. And I subsequently suffered from considerable amount of partial seizures and a full epileptic fit. And it was from there that I started to use my experience to talk to other people about how athletes react and how transparent we need to be and how much confidence we've got to have in them and trust in them that they can talk to us so that these situations are avoided. And, you know, that's 25, 30 years ago. And I think the sport's moved on at a great pace. Do I think it's got a huge amount more to learn? Yes. Do I think the drive to understand more? Yes, is crucial. And to do that, we've got to stay confident and we've got to keep seeking answers, because it is something that is incredibly concerning. But confidence, transparency, trust in people trying to find the answer is a huge part of trying to maintain our sport. And I've always used my situation to try and raise awareness, raise understanding, challenge current thinking so that we can continue to move forward.
And Dean, is it the sport and the medical aspect of rugby that needs to drive that? Or like how big a cultural difference do you see now amongst dressing rooms with regard to the players' openness to discuss concerns or to discuss incidents that they've experienced within games?
I think there's a huge change. And, that is cultural. Is, you know, we only knew what we knew 30 years ago, so it's impossible to say. We weren't reacting to it, to the knowledge that we have today, but changing rooms are very aware. I think players are very aware of the risks involved. Good environments encourage that, because the one thing concussion needs, it needs communication. It's not something that's easy visible. We talk lots about loss of consciousness, but concussion can manifest itself in many ways. And we need the athlete to tell us what's going on. And I believe good environments really encourage that. And I think, you know, any coaching and playing environment I'm involved in now, that's really prevalent, where people are encouraged to be vocal about the way they feel. And yes, that does bring probably more situations to light, but then we learn more and we can continue to learn more as the subject sort of plays itself out, because there's an enormous amount of things we still need to find out.
But it's leading to the game evolving as well, Coach, when you look at it. Like, everyone at home here in Ireland is speaking about the Josh van der Fleer incident with Tom Woods. And I don't know if you saw it, but it's a clean-out. Yeah, that, like, that's how I cleared out rucks. That's how we cleared out rucks. But the game is changing now. And I, just from a coaching point of view, how do you coach the breakdown now?
I think the key thing we all got to understand is certainly in professional rugby, there's still risk. And, you know, I don't think we would want to remove risk, but we've got to be aware of the risks. You know, when we talk about what was going on 25, 30 years ago, I'm not sure we're aware of the risks. And people say, you know, if you knew what you knew now, would you have behaved in the same way? Absolutely not. But I think we still got to accept that. You know, the central to the sport, it's a high contact sport. It has got risk attached. All we've got to do is make sure that we inform that risk and we mitigate it. I mean, there's, you know, my role when I was at the RFU was involved in concussion studies. And what we found that, you know, that sometimes there's a knee-jerk reaction that everyone needs to tackle low. We did a very short study in my time there, and actually concussions went up when the ball was played off nine, when you were asked to tackle low. So we've got to be really careful how we move forward. We've got to inform how we move forward, and we've got to make sure that we're working together to try and find the answers, because unintended consequences, something that we don't quite understand, could be enormous. And we have to be careful how we take our next steps.
Very true. In terms of, Dean, styles of play, I think it's been great to have the Champions Cup back to see kind of more free-flowing rugby. But England are setting the blaze at the moment when it comes to international rugby. The style is a bit, I don't know how you find it, but it is successful. What do you see this English team being able to do as they move on into the Six Nations coming up?
There's a man who spent his life chasing a ball in the air. I can't believe you're firing that across. I quite admire what England are doing at the moment, because I know how difficult it is to do. They've two left footers, two right footers in the back line. They create enormous pressure by their set piece. And at the moment, that's the best way to win. I understand, you know, that there's always something in the background nagging around entertainment. But I've never been in an unhappy winning changing room. And if you need to stick a ball in the air to do that, as you well know, is you'll get after it and chase it if you think it's the right way. And at the moment, it is the way the game is. I think, again, we've got to be careful of knee-jerk reactions and let things grow. Pressure rugby can manifest itself in many ways. And England are doing a pretty good job at the moment at creating enormous pressure on sides. And I think sides need to work out how to change that dynamic. And if they do, England need to work out how to adapt. So they'll be definitely at the forefront of this Six Nations. What I like is France. They don't choose to play pressure rugby. They choose to play wrist rugby. And that game will be something to see, which is the route that teams will choose.
Dean, I've never heard Dunica speak with such reverence to a guest who hasn't been born in Cork before. That's the ultimate compliment I can pay you. I'm just wondering, did you age 10 years in the time that this fellow was in your dressing room? And
absolutely. I can't believe that he called me vintage time when I was playing.
What is it like to have to manage Dunica O'Callaghan? It's okay,
question.
He won't take any legal action against you. You can speak freely.
Coach for a toy.
I mean, you can set up all you want, but Donica has his way of doing things, and it just carries on. It's one of those old dogs and new tricks. Is that the way I am? And all he does is apologise on Monday for not doing the new things you asked him to do.
Kick it to the corner. He was shouting it all the time.
Exactly. I remember once asking you, can you call a line out? He said, no, I've got 90 odd caps for Ireland, cuttle for the line. But I'm bloody good at dropping them, but I don't call them.
Do you know what? He's right.
You can't slag him.
He was right. He was right.
Dean, before we leave go, just one thing. Nigel Melville coming into the English fold. Do you think this will lead to maybe a ring fencing of the league, a greater knowledge towards a global calendar? What can we expect from him?
What I like about it is, I think, you know, CVC, you know, whether it's been criticised or whatever, as they come into PRL. I think initially they were seen to take a commercial front. They put a CEO in that was clearly commercially minded. What I like about it is going, getting those who understand the game. I'm a big friend of Nigel's. I've worked with him a couple of times now on the RFU in Gloucester. He's coached. He's been administrator, CEO of USA, acting CEO. That's great intellect. And CVC are clearly lining up things for the future so that they can maximise broadcast rights, and there's no better person to have than Nigel. So they'll certainly be better informed because of that. How things play out, you know, the dynamics between governing body, PRL and everything is always a challenge, but I'm sure they're in a better place for having him on board.
Just before I let you go, and maybe slightly on that, do you have any idea what's happening with the Pro 14 post-January? And I don't mean that disingenuously, but we talk about CVC and we talk about expanding leagues. We've a question mark over the South African expansion, and nobody seems to have a very solid idea, perhaps beyond the clubs themselves, as to what happens post these interprovincials and the two rounds of Europe.
I think there's always been a number of options on the table as the Pro 14 talks to South African counterparts, and however those talks are going. I understand that decisions are close. I think it would be wrong of me to give you a scoop on here, but we'd hope for some information in the coming days.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
Very good. Dean, as always, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. Best of luck against Cardiff and the Scarlets. You know we always cheer for you, bar one game a year. You know that.
Yeah, cheers, Mike. Good to speak to you.
Mind yourself. God bless. Cheers.
Game On 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Farm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Game On. European football.
Welcome back to Game On. Normally, European footballers throw their feet up at the Christmas period and enjoy the après ski. Not this year. They're out and at it, and we're delighted to be joined by Mark Langdon from the Racing Pulse. Mark, how are you?
Donahue, you okay?
Yes, we're great. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark. A bit of a different year. Normally, we wouldn't see as much football around Europe, but this year, COVID year, they're going to be going at it.
Absolutely, yeah. So everybody's basically playing this midweek before Christmas, and then Spain are playing in between. It's hard to keep up to date, isn't it, with the days during Christmas. But after Christmas, but before New Year, there is another round of La Liga matches as well to take in. So no kind of proper Christmas, New Year break going on. Even Germany have sort of curtailed their break. They're playing in the Cup this midweek, and then they're back pretty soon into the New Year. Of course, there's probably the country it's most famous for having a decent break. Usually, I think what it means is that come the Euros, it's just going to be survival of the fittest, really. Most of the players, I think, are already feeling the pinch, and we've seen that. You've only got to take one look at the results all around Europe, I think, at the moment. A lot of strange results. Very few teams, in terms of the big teams, are able to put any kind of consistent run together, and I don't really see how that's going to improve between now and, say, the European Championship, because it's just wall-to-wall football once again. Great, I think, for the fans who are watching it, but maybe not for the players and the international managers are probably not looking forward to what's going to be a very hectic second part of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, we might whistle around it, and if you don't mind, we'll start in Italy. Milan are unbeaten and sitting on top of Serie A, point ahead of their rivals Inter. What's of interest in the Christmas in Serie A?
Well, I mean, remarkable that they sort of maintained top spot there. They scored the fastest ever goal in Italian football history. I mean, certainly in terms of the top flight on Sunday, in a 2-1 win against Sassuolo. It was 6.8 seconds. Rafael Leao scored virtually straight from kickoff. Milan dribbled forward and he just found himself in acres of space and slid it in. So a bizarre start there. But I think the big story in Italy over sort of the last couple of hours is the fact that earlier on in the season, Juventus had been given a 3-0 win over Napoli, one of their title rivals, because Napoli refused to travel to Turin. They said it was on sort of local government advice after a COVID outbreak. Juventus turned up for the game, were given a 3-0 victory, and Napoli were deducted 1 point as well. Tonight, that has been reversed. So Napoli have got their point back, and that game must be replayed. And it just makes the league table look a little bit less healthy in terms of Juventus. I think it's the right decision, though, because you have to be very careful about sort of travel when there's sort of COVID in the camp. And the team that Napoli had played, 12 of their players ended up with the coronavirus. So I think Napoli did the right thing, and ultimately Italian football has come to the right conclusion. It would have been a lot of anger, I think, had Juventus won the league by, say, 1 or 2 points, and it had come down to, you know, being handed a game that they probably didn't deserve.
Mark, if we fly around some of the big European leagues, Germany, I don't know, from Dunica's perspective, of all that can be done to you as a player, someone to spit at you, I think, is the lowest of the low.
And
we've had, like, not just one incident in the Bundesliga this year, but two very, very prominent incidents. And Marcus Thuram, the son of a famous man, has paid quite a hefty and probably well-deserved penalty.
Yeah, so the son of Lilian Thuram, you know, one of the sort of most well-respected footballers sort of his generation. Yeah, his son, I think, he just disgraced himself really at the weekend. Plays for Borussia Mönchengladbach. Very frustrated, I think, with the way things were going. But obviously, absolutely no excuse for spitting in the face of an opponent. He received a 6-match ban. He was given a 1-month fine by Gladbach. A disgusting thing to do at the best of times, but certainly during a pandemic, I think he can count himself a little bit lucky that it was only 6 matches. We've seen in France, Gerson Martins was given a 6-month ban for putting his arms on a referee, another thing that I think deserves a hefty ban. But I'm not sure that there should be such a disparity between the two, and his apology was pretty weak as well. So I think he's quite lucky actually to only get a 6-game ban.
So just one or two of the other big stories of the week. Obviously, we've mentioned a record goal in Italy, we had a record goal in Germany, and it's managerial changing season across Europe as well, as evidenced by Schalke.
That's right. In terms of Schalke, Baum has gone. I mean, they're on the worst run, in their history. I've lost count. I think it's about 29 or 30 matches now they are without a victory. So they're closing in on the all-time Bundesliga record for games without a win, which would be shambolic for one of the biggest clubs in Germany. I think it's hard for people outside of Germany to realise just how big Schalke are. They're great rivals. Borussia Dortmund not doing well, apart from the fact that, as you mentioned there, 16-year-old Moukoko, who they've been desperately waiting. You're not allowed to play until you're 16 in Germany. He played soon after his 16th birthday. 16 years and 28 days, he finally got his first goal in the Bundesliga. Everybody in Germany thinks he's going to be a superstar, so definitely one to watch.
Okay, Mark, moving on to Spain and Benzema. He's come into his own after Ronaldo left and joined Juventus. Really assisting and helping his team to push on.
Yeah, there's probably a few strikers, I would say, in European football that sort of divide opinion as much as Benzema. There are some that can't believe that he's been at Real Madrid for so long, and you know, you can look at his goal scoring record, and before Ronaldo left it wasn't great, and he's obviously had his falling out and doesn't play for the French national team anymore for off-field issues. No foreign player has played for Real Madrid more than Karim Benzema, so you don't get that kind of record unless you're very good. He put the team before himself when Ronaldo was there, and he helped Ronaldo score a lot of the goals and did a lot of the donkey work for him. Since Ronaldo has left, he's stepped up and taken on that goal scoring responsibility. Zinedine Zidane absolutely loves him, so do all of the teammates. If Real Madrid are to win La Liga this season, it will probably, you know, if they are to do it, they're going to need a big second half of the campaign from Benzema. He's somebody that has sort of carried them through the first half of the campaign. They can't get Eden Hazard anywhere near the levels that we saw when he was at Chelsea. So at the moment, Benzema is leading that attack. He's leading it very well. But like I say, he's still somebody that divides opinion even after 10 years or so at Real Madrid.
Mark, we've a big debate going on in Gaelic football over here about finances and the impact it's had on success. I don't want to draw the parallel with Paris Saint-Germain, but they've won 7 of their 9 league titles since 2013. Monaco in 2017 broke a run that would have seen them, you know, do a clean sweep since then. It's looking an awful lot tighter in Ligue 1 this year than previous years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Paris Saint-Germain currently third in a one-horse race, but behind Lyon and Lille. It is close, and you would expect them to eventually come out on top, but they could only draw 0-0 away to Lille, and that they weren't particularly good at the weekend either. I do think that playing the Champions League final, you know, and the French season had already started when they were playing that Champions League final. They had to go straight from the Champions League final into domestic football. The disappointment of losing that European Cup to Bayern Munich and then having to play, I don't know, Mets or somebody like that. I think it's very difficult for the players to kind of get over that heartache and then go on and sort of play these domestic matches, and their season hasn't really started yet. They nearly went out of the Champions League, just about saved themselves, raised their level at Old Trafford to make sure they beat Manchester United. So we know that they've got it in them to play at the very highest level. They just don't show it very often, and looks like they're trying to save their best for the Champions League. But I think everybody outside of Paris Saint-Germain fans will be cheering on Lyon and Lille over the second half of the season. Hopefully one of them can win the title, but I very much doubt it.
Mark, as always, thanks so much for joining us on Game On, not only tonight but all through the year, where you've kept us up to speed with everything going on around Europe. We really appreciate it, and we'll chat to you soon. Mind yourself.
Thanks, Donica. Thanks, Damien.
Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Welcome back to Game On. Okay, if you've had enough of Home Alone, Elf and Miracle on 34th Street, Ciarán Walsh has created the perfect sports drama for you over the Christmas. And we're delighted he joins us now. Ciarán, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me on.
No, thanks so much, not only for joining us, but your movie. I think I'm at a point at the moment where I'm watching an awful lot of Christmas stuff, and to watch The Racer today was incredible, because I think it gives a real throwback to what was an awful lot of us would remember, the Tour de France, which started in Ireland in 1998, but a real insight into the side maybe that you wouldn't see from the cyclist's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, what I was really interested in exploring was the idea of these domestiques, these support riders. And it takes a particular kind of person to decide to devote their life to somebody else's glory. And so that was kind of like the starting point. And then we myself and the co-writer, Ciarán Cassidy, were interested in what happened in Ireland in 1998. It was kind of known as the Tour de Dopage, or the Tour of Shame, because of the amount of drugs that were in the sport. And interestingly, the Tour de France organizers thought this was going to be the end of the Tour de France, that there wouldn't be another one potentially, because it was so corrupt, you know. So they put in a lot of structures to try and stamp out the drugs in the sport and try and, you know, rectify things. They brought in blood passports and stuff like that. And for the next 7 years, Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France.
So they did a great job of cleaning it up, as we would have expected. Can I ask you, obviously we don't want to give an awful lot away, but anyone who is aware of the history of racing and is aware of the history of that tour will know that doping will feature in the film. And it's very, very powerful scenes early on when we get an insight into the darker side of cycling. And we might talk in a second about trying to get the cycling scenes right, but trying to get the doping scenes right is quite a challenge, I'd imagine, because while we've had a bit of insight and a bit of revelation over the years, we've never really had someone come out and talk about the ins and outs and the intricacies of blood doping in particular.
No, there's been a couple of anonymous accounts of, you know, how the blood transfusions happen. And we have an idea about how to take EPO, the amount of EPO and the level we're not too sure about. I did try and speak to some ex-cyclists about that, and there was kind of silence when I approached whether the scenes that I'd written were realistic or whether they'd, you know, hit the mark. And it wasn't, they weren't saying they weren't, and they weren't saying they were, but because by saying anything, it implicates themselves, it's, you know, and they didn't want to do that, you know. So it was really kind of, there's a number of books and a number of accounts. There's one particular book called The End of the Road by Alistair Fotheringham, which is basically, you know, the 98 tour and what went on in the hotel rooms in Dublin. But again, it's, some of it is hearsay and speculative, and there was stories of riders running up and down corridors trying to keep their heartbeats up in the middle of the night, and noises of bikes whirring away in rooms in the middle of the night. So those kind of things is how we put it together.
And I think, is it Charlie Weglis as well as the guy who had the book about being a domestique, which I know an awful lot of people within the cycling community have tried to come out and perhaps distance or question the accuracy of some of what he's written, but equally people who want to see cycling cleaned up have said that his is almost the definitive account of what it is like to be a domestique.
Yeah, that was very informative, that book. It's just called Domestique, and kind of, and he was in an unfortunate position that he had a natural very high hematocrit level, which meant that the effects that EPO has on a normal person is what he has in his blood system anyway, you know? Mm-hmm. So anytime he got tested, they immediately pointed the finger and said he was doing EPO, where in actual fact, he wasn't doing it at all. But there's another book by Tyler Hamilton, which is a remarkable book about his life in the tour and life in competitive cycling. And it's so intense. It's like reading a thriller. Honest to God, it was just an amazing account of. So between those two sources, it was really helpful in terms of what they could have been up to behind the scenes.
Rightly, we do speak about the drugs when it comes to sports like that, and especially at that time. But for domestiques, it's a selfless task, isn't it? And, you know, beyond everything else, they always put the team first. And I think in your movie, The Racer, it captured it brilliantly.
Yeah, they do. The only kind of glory or only kind of praise they get is within the team itself. You see it on the tour bus when he helps his charge, you know, his lead out man, or sorry, his leading rider over the line. He gets lots of praise in the bus and stuff like that, but he's beginning to kind of waver and think this is all just sycophantic behavior. So yeah, it's an interesting choice, you know, to become a domestique. And that's why I thought, rather than tell the story of a champion rider, tell the story of a domestique. We've seen plenty of films about champion riders, and this was an opportunity to tell a different story.
And as with all good films, cycling is just the backdrop against which we have inner turmoils and questions of conscience and ambitions and everything else. But for sporting films, you know, I'm thinking of, just say, like Mickey Rourke's The Wrestler was commended so much because it got the wrestling scenes so right. So from your perspective, how much of a challenge was it to get actors on board who could represent the physical act of cycling? And, you know, because if you don't have that portrayed accurately, you're going to lose an awful lot of people straight away.
Well, you know, getting wrestling scenes, for example, in The Wrestler, or, you know, I mean, and the wrestling in that, let's be honest, it wasn't champion wrestling. It was kind of just, it was almost like clowning around, which what they were doing in the ring in that particular film. But unfortunately, with a film like The Racer, we had to try and recreate the Tour de France in 1998. So it's a period film already. But we also had to, you know, basically, you know, there's 180 odd riders in the peloton that year, you know, and then there's all these fans along the side of the road. And we're operating on a fairly modest budget, to be honest, you know. So that was a challenge in itself. Actually finding actors who are fit enough to do it. We found this one guy, Louis Talp, who is a kids actor predominantly in Belgium. And as a result, he's kind of a household name. But he's also a cycling fanatic, and he's known as a cycling fanatic. So he can act and he can look good on a bike and ride very, very well. He does Ironman three times a year. He's quite an amazing athlete. So it came together perfectly in that particular instance. Most young actors are quite fit now, but we had the help of Paul McQuaid, who's Pat McQuaid's brother. Pat McQuaid brought the Tour to Ireland in 1998. So he had Paul, who's an ex-domestique himself, on as technical advisor, helping us making sure that they look good on the bikes and that they learn how to ride together as a team and stuff like that. So it was hard. It was hard work, you know. So we did the best we could.
Yeah, you certainly did. It's a fantastic film, The Racer. We'd highly recommend anyone to see it.